The Liminalist, the podcast between at horticulture.com. This is Jason Horsley, the podcast between, talking to Anil Pandey on transhumanism. The other one was very electronic sounding. It was very obvious that I wasn't really hearing you, but I was hearing a reproduction of you, which I guess is the topic of the day. So I'd rather talk to the real Anil, if that's possible.
Yeah, this should be good.
So I was surprised to hear that you'd done a podcast, because I guess I thought that generally you were somebody who wanted to keep a low profile.
Yeah, that's all changed.
It's all changed. Right. So is that the first that you've done?
Yeah, I've only done one.
Right. So you want to get the message out there.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And hence you're talking to me, because that's part of that.
Right. Right.
Right. Well, you and I have had many, many conversations over the years, and so... this is different, of course. We haven't spoken in, how long has it been? Like 2-3 years?
I think it was it like fall of 2015? I think.
Okay, so that would be just coming up to 2 years.
I think so. I think that's when it was.
So, do you know the reason that I suggested that we do this podcast? I mean, did I say the reason? And if so, do you remember? And if not, could you guess it?
Back then?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it was, because I've, my whole, since I started my company was named Transcender Corporation, meaning transcender as in transcending DNA, separating the biological line of evolution from the cultural line of evolution. So, and then of course, you've written, when did you write that blog on transhumanism that you...
Do you mean the Prisoner of Infinity chapter?
Yeah, the one you sent me the link to.
That was, I think that came out probably a couple of years ago or less, but I'm not sure when I first wrote it. I mean, Prisoner of Infinity, I started in 2013, and it didn't begin as a thing about transhumanism, but it pretty quickly... I don't know if you read the chapter on Ray Kurzweil, because that was earlier on. That's like chapter 4 of Prisoner Infinity. So very, very quickly I saw a correspondence between Strieber's Weltanschauung, his worldview, and Kurzweil's, and an overlap there between the mystical kind of paradigm, including Castaneda, and then the more technology-based one. It wasn't supposed to be a work about... I don't consider it to be a work about transhumanism. It's just that I use transhumanism as another example of what I'm exploring.
Right, yeah. I think it had to do with that whole thing that since you were... That was occupying your consciousness to some extent, and that was like kind of what I'm all about. There was a cross-section there.
Right. I mean, I don't know transhumanists, and transhumanists don't listen to what I do or read what I do generally, because, well, they wouldn't. So there's this intersection, or potentially a collision, but anyway, a meeting of worlds here, in that your worldview and my worldview don't really... agree. I mean, they don't really overlap hardly, even though we've had an ongoing correspondence. I'm talking to you as somebody who well, somebody who has a very different interest in this subject matter to myself.
Right. Now, did you read through that transcript of the podcast or listen to it?
I did listen to some of it. I didn't read through the transcript. I didn't think it would be necessary, really. Well, yeah, go on.
Oh, I was just wondering. I mean, because it's pretty. It kind of states my whole shtick, I guess.
Well, one thing I heard right away, it seemed, because you sent me the YouTube video and it started at a certain point, so I presume that was the point you wanted me to start listening. And pretty soon after that point, I heard you say that if and when you were able to translate your consciousness into digital data and create a replica of yourself that would continue without the biological, you know, nexus, you yourself would just experience going unconscious, going into sleep, death, and wouldn't be continuity from your point of view. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, when when my physical, I mean, when my biological body is dead, you know. Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, it's like what really matters. What matters is if I'm replaced with an android, that you can't tell the difference. I mean, my friend, like, if it's programmed well enough and done right, you know, I could, you know, if I don't wake up one morning and this android steps into my place and nobody can tell the difference, I mean, is that not a continuity of my persona?
If it passes the Turing test, you mean?
Right. Yeah.
Well, so that seems a very selfless point of view. Like, if you just want to replicate yourself and have technological immortality, just so the world can continue to experience Anil, as opposed to so that Anil himself can continue, that's quite unusual, I think. For most transhumanists, I think, are interested in personal immortality that they get to experience.
You mean they want their biological body to continue indefinitely?
No, they want their consciousness to continue indefinitely. They want to be conscious. They want continuity of consciousness between, you know, death and technological rebirth.
Well, how is that different than me replicating my persona from an outside point of view?
Well, from an outside point of view, it isn't different, but from your point of view, it would be completely different. I mean, from your point of view, unless I misunderstood, there'd be no difference between just dying like anyone else and you know, reproducing yourself technologically into this sort of android version of yourself. There's no difference from your point of view.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I go to sleep at night, I mean, it's like do you mean that they think that their ego is gonna, like, continue on? Like,
mm-hmm. Well, isn't that what we're talking about? We're talking about apparently it's not what you're talking about, because you're talking about, well, I'm not quite clear what you're talking about. Let's just make sure that I have got it right. As you describe it and as you're envisioning it, you would reproduce your consciousness or whatever, your memories and whatnot, your personality, so that it was able to be programmed into an android body, and that android body would continue to exist after you died, but that from your point of view, you would simply die and cease to exist. Is that right?
Right. Once my body goes, that's the end of this body. But your ego dies every night, right? I mean, there's
but you wake up again and it's there. So are you saying in this scenario that you would wake up again in an android body, or are you saying that you wouldn't wake up again?
If this thing cannot be distinguished, you know, if the persona is replicated exactly, then and this thing is walking around, I mean, who's to say that's not my consciousness in there? I mean,
well, nobody except you. But let's use an example then. What if you were to do this replication of your memories and personality, put it in an android body before you died, and then get up in the morning and there you are, that you meet yourself as an android and you have a conversation with yourself? Then you would be what, in two places at once, or would you just be the one, Anil, or would you be you know? So that's what I'm saying about there's a difference to you. It doesn't matter what, well, unless you're being completely altruistic, unless you're saying you don't care if you just die and disappear forever from existence, as long as there's a replica of you going around that other people can get to encounter. That would be, as I say, very altruistic. You're just thinking that it's kind of like somebody donating their organ, I guess. It would be something similar to that. You would be donating your memories and your knowledge base to the future, but you yourself would just be, you know, snuffed out, just like anyone else who didn't do that, didn't make that donation.
Right. Now, so let's say that we put you like in a Star Trek, you know, transporter, and you know, it beamed like another one of you, but the original one stuck around, and so there were like two. Let's say we rebuilt, you know, Jason molecule by molecule, like exactly like you are now, and then it you woke up in the morning and then this thing was there and you met it. What would that would that be you? I mean, if we,
well, I presume it wouldn't. I mean, because I would be the one person who could say, wait a minute, that's not me. Unless, as I say, I found myself looking from two points of view at the same time, and I'm, oh my God, I've split in two, then I don't know what I would say except that, maybe.
Yeah,
right?
But this other thing that's been built from the ground up, molecule my molecule, he would say the same thing about the other guy, right?
Yeah, it might. It might well say that I was the imposter. That's possibly true, yeah.
I would think, I mean, if it's identical molecule for molecule, I mean, down to like the last quantum position of every atom, like if you could somehow make this, you know, star, you know, have one of those Star Trek transporters where it doesn't destroy the, I guess how that thing works is it rebuilds, you know, the entire molecular structure down on the planet and then destroys the version of you that stepped into the transporter. I mean, is that how that works?
Obviously I don't know how the transporter works because it's fictional, but I remember reading something, whether there's any validity in it or not, about how teleportation might work, might be possible, and that had to do with sending not sending atoms across space, but sending spin, as in the information that is contained in the atoms, making a copy of that information and sending it, you know, faster than the speed of light, so that it lands on another bunch of atoms and then instantly reassembles those atoms according to its spin, right? So then, in fact, the original atoms wouldn't have been changed. So, but that wouldn't be teleportation. Well, you would have to destroy the first person then, because otherwise it wouldn't be teleportation. It would be replication, multiplication.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not sure what they said about what they would do with the original spin, if you see what I mean. Like, if they're making a copy of that information, sending it to a bunch of other atoms so that they rearrange themselves into the form of that information, then what happens to the original? We're getting very abstract, and you right away you went into a fictional model, Star Trek. So of course we can speculate till the replicants come home about this, because it's fantasy. But I know from what you said, or I think I do, that you don't consider this a fantasy. You consider this something that you hope to achieve in this lifetime, is that right?
Right, but you brought up, you know, if this thing were built and then it met you, you didn't die, it like met you in the morning when you woke up, you know, what would happen? And I'm just kind of saying, well, what if this android, instead of being an android, it was just a molecule for molecule exact replica of you? You'd have two guys pointing at each other saying, you're the imposter, no, you're the imposter, no, you're the imposter, right? I mean, that's what would happen in your scenario, right?
Yeah, but again, that's from the outside, and so again, it may be true that even then, nobody else would know which was the real Anil or the real me. But I guess you yourself would start to doubt it at that point. Like, oh my God, am I a replica or am I the real thing? But anyway,
well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly what would happen. Is you know, in the scenario you gave, you know, they, you know, obviously the android would say, well, I'm the imposter here, because if I cut my, you know, arm open here, I see electronics, so obviously I'm the imposter. But if that weren't the case, you know, you'd have two people, and both of them either thinking they're both the imposter, or, you know, one, you know, the imposter might think he's the real one, and the real one might say, oh darn, I'm the imposter. I mean,
well, except they would have exactly the same personality based on your premise, so wouldn't they even be saying the same things at the same time? I mean, would they even be able to have a conversation? Right? We don't know what would happen under those circumstances. They might both drop dead of a heart attack, or there might be like matter meeting antimatter. There might be no way for the universe to accommodate something like that. We're not going to know until we actually, if we can ever achieve something that is hard to even think about, we're not going to know what it's like to experience it. But my main question here, which seems that you don't quite, I don't know if you don't understand it or what it is, but it's just, I mean, you Anil, you get up in the morning, you go about your day, you do things, sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're sad, sometimes you're angry, sometimes you're kind, so on. You know, you've got this personality that keeps changing and moods, but basically you have a consistent experience of existing, except when you fall asleep. Is that right?
Right, but I mean, I think that scenario that you gave is making some assumptions, and I'm just trying to get to the bottom of what those are, and that's kind of why I went back to, like, you know, if this second being is, you know, biological, replicated, you know, molecule for molecule, I mean, those, I don't think that there's, that the universe is going to have any problem handling, you know, that. I mean, I think it's not that far-fetched, I suppose, to say that you could rebuild some, you know, a human. I mean, we're talking maybe like 1,000 or 2,000 years from now, but to actually rebuild a biological being molecule for molecule.
Well, I mean, what's far-fetched and what isn't is, I mean, that's really the crux of any conversation between you and I about this, because that's entirely subjective. So, I mean, actually, yeah, I say that is far-fetched, and you'd say, no, it isn't, and we're not really going to get anywhere there, because that's exactly what we're exploring here, you know, why I think this is an impossible scenario and why you think it's not far-fetched. And I don't want to keep banging on this thing, mm-hmm. because it seems like I am, but I really am genuinely curious, like, are you not, as a personality who experiences continuity of existence on a daily basis, and like all of us is seeking a better experience of life, I presume, aren't you concerned with how you will experience yourself any of these miraculous, or perhaps not that far-fetched, technological advances that you're trying to accomplish? Like, what's in it for you? I still don't understand what's in it for you, personally.
It seems that you want to project upon it that I want to defeat death. You know, that I want to outsmart death. That right.
If you want to say project, I mean, then you need to explain to me why you're not talking about that. Like, how is this not cheating death?
Well, because it my biological body, when that dies, that's the end of it, and so it seems to me that you're projecting that the transhumanists say that it's not the persona that's being replicated, but the ego.
What's the difference between a persona and an ego?
Well, the ego is that internal chatterbox that is communicating with you right now. And the persona is my outward interface with the outside world, with you. You don't have direct access to my ego. You have direct access to my persona.
But you just said the internal chatterbox is what's communicating with me now.
Well, it's I guess it's kind of like your computer and the speaker on your computer, or you're on your, yeah. I mean, the persona is the speaker, and the ego is the microprocessor. If you're listening to, if your computer is playing music, you're listening to the speakers. You that's what you have access to. That's what yours mm-hmm. have access to. What's going on behind there? You can't. I mean, unless you take a crowbar and pry open the computer and look at what's happening in there. Those speakers are the only thing you really have to go by.
Mm-hmm. So which is it that you're saying that would get reproduced into the android version of you? Is it the ego or is it the persona?
Well, definitely the persona is going to, the persona, my persona and the android's, my biological body's persona and the android's persona will be unable to be differentiated. I mean, that will, if it's done right, then it'll pass the Turing test. And I mean, you just won't know. Now, and I guess the question you're asking is, what's going on behind the scenes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is not really known. I mean, it's gonna, since it's in a different medium, and it's not like neurons and neurotransmitters and everything like that. I mean, it's like taking a Windows computer and saying, okay, well, now we're gonna try to run this program on an Apple, and then you're asking these questions about, well, what's the difference between what's going on internally on the Apple versus the Windows computer? But I'm telling you, all you have access to is the speakers.
So tell me then why I would want this. Like, if you were designing this app or whatever, and you were marketing it, how would you sell it? Like, why would I want to create a replica of my persona so that it would fool people after I die into thinking I'm still around? Or it could, if it wanted to.
Well, why are you here in the first place?
That's how you're going to market it? Because that's putting a lot of onus on the buyer there. Like, I mean, I can answer that, but then, of course, we'll get into a whole other thing.
Right.
Like, what's the practical?
Well, the practicality of it is that right now in my ego seeks, alignment with the universe. Okay. That I've determined, if I want to minimize my suffering and have a happy life, I want to fulfill the mission that I was put here to fulfill. And so, in order to get onto that, the proper vector, to do that, that requires me to perform certain tasks. And the problem with completing those tasks is that my biological body, you know, can't make it more than like another 50 years. I mean, I probably wouldn't want it to. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, just the way cells just are making a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy and degrades, and that's what causes aging. And then you end up with, you know, a frail body and everything like that. I mean, I don't want to. I mean, I'd like to extend. You know, I'll do all the medical stuff and try to extend that as far as possible. But that this biological body, just. I mean, even if it was 1,000 years, you know, after 1,000 years, I'm going to say, you know, this is just not, you know, worth the inconvenience of you know, be just too burdensome to put up with an aging body. So. I would be unable to complete that mission in that body, so I better have another one.
Another body to complete the mission so that your ego is in alignment with the universe and you don't get to suffer anymore or so much. So then that does imply that you want your ego to be around long enough to get in an alignment with the universe and have a suffering free existence.
Are you asking that before or after my biological body dies?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're the one who's creating these new maps of possibility, so you tell me.
Right. Well, it's my body right now is going to die at some point, and which means that it, when that happens, if I haven't made some kind of plans for it to continue, then I'll fail in my mission. I won't be able to achieve my purpose in life.
Okay, just before we continue, if you can move your mic a little further, because it's still getting a lot of that sound effects.
Okay, is that better?
Yeah, so what you're saying is that your ego continues after your death, or that you want and need it to, in order to complete its mission of getting in alignment with the universe. I mean, are you saying that your ego, like, what will happen in your worldview if you don't manage to find a way to for your ego to continue after your biological death? Is your ego going to die with your body?
That, I mean, that's kind of hard to, the ego is something that, I mean, when it makes it over into silicon, it's obvious, since it's in a different medium, I don't think you can say that it's exactly the same ego, whereas if you're talking about the persona, which is all the universe really cares about, I mean, it, you know, nothing, you know, the people would care about how your persona acts, how that interface acts, and there's no direct access to this ego. There's no, I don't know that there should not be a way to test whether that ego in there is the same or not without physically taking it apart.
Mm-hmm. But you, I mean, you went right ahead to like creating a new technological ego, whereas what I asked was what you think happens to the ego on death normally, and what will happen if you don't achieve any of these particular ends. Does it have some life outside of the biological organism?
Well, in the android that has exactly the same persona, in order to make that persona run properly, I would imagine that I will have replicated this monologue that I have running in my mind that I consider to be me.
And you do consider that to be you?
Well, I consider it to be my mind, which is part of which is, you know, sitting on top of my brain, which is part of my body.
Mm-hmm. Right, but is that what you consider to be you then, the monologue, or is that just part of what you consider to be you?
What else could it be?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I read recently, I tweeted it, a guy, he's a forerunner, he's a whatever, a guinea pig, he's having a head transplant, which at first I thought meant he was having somebody else's head put on his body, but it's actually, as you might predict, it's the opposite. He's having his head put on somebody else's body. And they don't know if it's going to work, and there's a million reasons why it won't, even without getting into any kind of metaphysical or spiritual perspective, just in terms of, you know, how the neurons need to connect to the familiar neuron and what have you. Anyway, you know, in your view, would that be just as much you, if that worked, if that operation worked, and you were able to transplant your head onto somebody else's body, no matter whose body, let's say a fat lesbian from Milwaukee, well, actually, we won't give you a sex change, but whatever, you know, just a guy that was very completely dissimilar to you in every other way, would that still be as much you as previously in your view, or would you have lost some vital portion of yourself, or replaced it with something that wasn't entirely you, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, since you're losing your heart and your digestive systems, those are pretty large, you know, neuronal systems that you know have brains, so to speak. If you define neurons as a brain, so you're kind of losing those two thought systems, neuron systems. So that could give unpredictable results.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a surprising response, because I thought that maybe you would just say no, that it would still be you, because that who you really are is this mind sitting on top of your brain. That's what I would have expected. Because, I mean, based on what you said, and I, of course, would agree, who we are and how we experience ourselves as consciousness is intricately dependent on the whole nervous system, the whole biological organism, and, you know, all the different parts working together. And, I'm at the other extreme. I didn't even want to have my wisdom teeth removed, because I felt that was part of who I am, you know, part of my consciousness in some way. So, I mean, that's my viewpoint, and it sounds like you're not as far from that viewpoint as I thought, if you're acknowledging that consciousness is dependent on neurology or your consciousness.
Right. Now, you've got this monologue going on in your body somewhere. Do you feel it's localized to your brain or your head, or
Do I feel it that way? I mean, do I experience it? I associate it with my head for sure.
But do I
actually think that it is localized to there? No, actually, in some sense, I get the feeling that it's almost outside of my body, like it's coming from outside of the body. I mean, I'm not saying that's true, but that's partially how I experience it, I think.
Right, but yeah, and I think that monologue is generated from the three main places that monologue is generated from, or from your neuron systems, which would mean it includes your brain, your heart, your digestive system, and then, you know, maybe your other organs have smaller systems also. And I would imagine that my heart, the neuron systems in my heart have some input into what thought comes into this monologue next.
Well, so now we're getting into some very fundamental questions, philosophical and what have you. As in, you know, where does thought come from, and you know, to what extent is it synonymous with consciousness? So, do you think that there's a difference between an organism being conscious through perception? So, like, we're sitting wherever we're sitting right now at a computer, and we're in an environment, and like, I'm aware of the curtain on the window moving in the wind, and the sensation of the seat under my buttocks, and the feeling of the clothes on my skin, and, you know, there's all this data that's coming in that I'm experiencing perceptually. And then there's this internal monologue which is mostly ignoring that. I mean, it's actually, I'm not aware of these sensory data, the perceptual data, most of it, I'm not even aware of it in a thinking level until I choose to look for it, right? So, what's the difference there? Like, because from my point of view, what you talk about the intestinal neural system and the heart neural system and the brain neural system, I would say that is intrinsic to processing perception, but I wouldn't say that it's generating our thoughts. I would say our thoughts are probably... and also, I wouldn't say that our thoughts are necessary to be conscious or perceive. Like, I wanted to make this a question, not a statement of my own thing. But do you associate thinking with consciousness, or do you have any sense of a form, a kind of consciousness that is available to you that doesn't require thinking.
Okay, so I mean, I guess we need to define what you mean by consciousness. Are we going to agree that that means awareness?
Well, it's not synonymous, but yeah, consciousness is conscious. Well, funny enough, I was going to go even deeper with you today. I was thinking about it, talking and about the question of whether it's possible to be conscious without any content. Consciousness without content. So that's at one spectrum, and we don't have to go there because that obviously is impossible to think about. But what I was suggesting, somewhere in between the consciousness where you described the monologue, where we're basically telling ourselves what we're experiencing the whole time, somewhere that's closer to the middle of the spectrum, where we're conscious of perceptual information, but not of a monologue. Like, we're not telling ourselves it's hot and this table is hard and this, you know, this body is soft. You know what I mean? Like, the monologue is constantly interpreting and recording and commenting on and telling ourselves how we feel about things. But do you ever experience that there's something prior to that that is closer to just pure consciousness of what the organism is perceiving?
Okay. Well, I guess the it says here consciousness is the awareness or perception of something by a person, the fact of awareness by the mind of itself and the world.
What definition is that?
From the Google. I just entered define consciousness.
Okay, so the Google cloud is done.
Yeah, the Google cloud. I can go to the Merriam-Webster thing. Let's see what Merriam-Webster has to say. Quality, consciousness, the quality or state of being aware, especially of something within oneself. The state or fact of being conscious of an external object, state, or fact. The state of being characterized by sensation, emotion, volition, and thought, mind.
Well, let's use a concrete example. You're walking in the forest, and out of nowhere, a beetle flies smack bang into the side of your head. You're going to experience, I imagine, if you're anything like me, you're going to become conscious of that beetle hitting your head before you have any thoughts at all about it. Like, your thoughts are going to have to catch up with that experience.
You're saying that the skin cells are going to register that they've been struck before, and then they're going to send a message through the nerves to my brain, and then my brain is going to notify my mind that something has happened, and then my mind is going to say, what was that? And it's going to say, oh darn, it was a beetle.
Eventually it'll figure out it's a
beetle. Eventually, so and I mean, if you have an Android or whatever, I mean, before its monologue starts commenting on that, well, yeah, of course the sensors on the skin are going to pick that up, and so you could say technically, you know, it that the being, the android, is aware that the moment the sensor is triggered.
All right, well, this is an interesting sort of fork in the road here, because I know that you believe in psychism because you've had experiences that you consider to be psychic, right? I mean, whether you use that term or not, extra consensual, or that don't appear to be sourced in the physical senses.
Well, that's because we're in a simulation right now.
I said it was probably going to be a fork. I was hoping it wouldn't be that big a fork. But okay, so before we get to the simulation, though,
And let me just clarify what I mean by simulation, because I was like, before you called, I was like just kind of fuming over the way things get named. Like for example, you know, someone decided to name a disease after, you know, a sign in the zodiac, Cancer, and then they decided to call like this you know, Down syndrome type thing Mongolism, but yet, you know, there's a country called Mongolia, and they're one of Mongoloids are one of the three races, and they call black holes when they're, you know, super compact objects, and what triggered all of that in my mind was, you know, that they're calling this a simulation, and so I'm just kind of stuck having to use that terminology. But that's when we get to that, I guess we'll talk about it.
Okay. Interesting. I mean, interesting what you introduced there, the whole notion of language and how it misrepresents reality is obviously a key subject. So, but before we get there, if we do, bring it back to this I mean, I would say it is the body that's able to experience things through senses beside what we know of as the five senses, but regardless, I mean, I know some scientists are saying we've got 64 senses and so on and so forth. So, but regardless of how we experience it, that we are capable of becoming conscious of things before we think about them, before we're able to think about them, such as the beetle, that could extend to even non-physical phenomena. It could extend to, well, we don't really know how far it extends in terms of what we're able to be conscious of. And I guess if the point, if any, then, and I suspect you'd agree with this, even though your worldview doesn't seem to, what the mind can encompass, think about, interpret, analyze, understand, is a very small bandwidth compared to what we're actually able to tune into as consciousness.
Right. Well, the sensors on your skin when the beetle, you know, hits them are triggered, and they it's kind of like if you're in the doctor's office and he hits your knee with that hammer or whatever, and your leg goes forward, that all happens before you've processed that in your mind.
That's a reflex, so right. I don't know if it's exactly parallel. I'll give you another example. It's one I used in Prisoner Infinity, I think. I don't know, maybe I took it out later, but it's from Julian James, The Origin of Consciousness. Have you read that book?
No.
By Cameral Mind. I think it would interest you. And he uses the example relating to the mind and how we give it too much credit of two glasses of water, you know, one's full and the other's half empty. And then he says, you know, put them in front of you, close your eyes, and then move them around with your hands on the tables until you can't remember which one is which. You could do this experiment, obviously not right now, but anyway, and then pick them both up with each hand and gauge which one is full and which one is half empty. Now, his point is it'd be very easy for us to know which is half full, right, and which is empty. Mm-hmm. But what is it that's telling us that?
The weight.
It's the weight, the experience of the body. The body simply knows which is full and which is half empty. The mind actually doesn't do anything there except report to some part of us, or report to itself, really, oh, it's that one. The body has already determined before the mind comments on it. That's his point, and I would agree. I don't know what you would say. Like animals know these things, right? They don't do it with the glass of water, but they know things instinctively, physically. They just have a physical sense of spatial dimensions and weight and speed and all these things, and they don't.
Well,
I mean, this is
well,
tricky.
I would, without trying it myself and thinking about it just off the cuff, I would say that that's no different than, you know, when the doctor, you know, hits, you know, it's your body knows reflexively which one is heavy and which one is light. I mean, that's kind of like a reflex.
Well, there is a difference. I mean, the body's being hit, so then it's reacting. So it's the difference because, but anyway, carry on. I mean, what's your point? Well, even if they are the same, what's your point?
Well, your body is reacting to the resistance that it feels. I mean, your hand, you know, your arm your arm knows, because with one it's being pushed down harder than with the other, so your arm knows immediately, and I would just say that's a reflex.
Okay, so are you saying that it doesn't correlate with consciousness?
Well, I mean, if you want to impute consciousness into my arm, well, then it does.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, yeah, and so that you know, because I mean, we're all a conglomeration of, you know, your organs have their own little agenda and meeting, and then, you know, down to the cells and the you know, we're a conglomeration of these cellular machines, and, you know, a bacteria engulfed a mitochondria and made it part of itself, and so you've got all these little, you know, teams within you that have their own little, you know, each organ, you know, has its own little fiefdom in there, mm-hmm. with its job and everything like that. So I mean, you could, you know, and then you have the heart, you know, has its own neuron system and its whole thing. So, you know, and all of these systems within you, if something important enough happens, they send a notification to your mind.
Does the mind contribute to all of this, in your opinion?
Well, when your arm becomes conscious of a greater resistance in one or the other, it says, well, this one is giving me more resistance, and so then your mind says, okay, well, if the heavier one is the one that's completely full. And so now I got to tell Jason, okay, well, this is the one that's full in English. It translates it into English so that I can report it to you.
Into language. So that's relating it to communication. But you could, you wouldn't have to go as far into communication. You could say that if it was doing it with two oranges, it's the body determines which is the larger orange based on weight, and then the mind makes a decision, I want this orange, you can have that orange. Right?
Right, yeah, there you go.
So there's decision, possibly a decision. I mean, I think this is still questionable. It could be that the body, that the same capacity of the body that is able to determine which orange is larger is also able to, you know, hold on to one and extend the other. I don't know, but there is a basic theory of what we think of as self-awareness, you know, the thinking, let's just call it thinking, that it came about when instincts were in conflict, when our environment became overly complex, and so we weren't able to simply act instinctively. We had to start weighing up, metaphorically, different options and reaching a decision.
Well, I would give you the larger one because I'm a generous person. And so, I mean, uh-huh. There's not really, I mean, my arm is not going to, you know, compute, oh, am I in a generous mood today or not?
Well, I mean, that's an assumption. That is an assumption. And what we're exploring here is how important is the mind, how essential is the mind to what we are, you know? How close is it to our essential self? As you know, I don't consider it to be very close at all. And you've talked about the ego. Let's bring it back to the ego as well. So you said that your ego wants to align with the universe. Now, I would question that, and I'm not really here to question you. We're here to have a conversation. But my input is no. Anil's ego does not want to align with the universe. I mean, that's A, my experience of you, and B, that's my experience of myself and of the world. Like, the ego is hardwired to resist aligning with the universe. It does want to avoid suffering, but it wants to do it by having complete control over the universe, not by aligning with it, not by surrendering to it. So, but anyway, that's, you know, that's just my opinion, let's say, or my experience. But in terms of what it is that, I mean, we didn't ever really get to what it is that you think the ego is, and how it is that it transcends the body. Because, I mean, even if, like, you give more stock to thinking and ego, mind, than I do, because you say that it's generated by the heart and the intestines and the brain and all that. So, but even from that model, which is very generous, I'd say it's giving the mind an awful lot of stock, is dependent on the body.
Well, the mind is receiving all of these reports
from the organs and whatnot.
Right, and so it, you know, like the situation where with the oranges, it has to evaluate, you know, if it's not. The arm is not necessarily always going to choose the larger one. You know, the arm, you know, let's say it's whether there's two oranges, it might be, you know, oh, well, I'm going to take the smaller one for myself because I'm a generous person. I mean, you're making assumptions there that the in that case, maybe you follow what I'm saying. I mean, the mind.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't matter. I mean, the point was just that the body can determine and then base a decision on what it's determined.
Are you saying the arm makes the decision as to whether to give you the bigger one or the smaller one?
No, I wasn't. I was leaving that open. But I was allowing that, yeah, if a decision is required, then some sort of calculation comes in, whether it's a calculation to be generous or a calculation to be self, you know, self-serving.
Right, and so if you have a selfish ego, then you're going to take the larger one, and if you have a generous ego, then you're going to give the heavier one to the other guy.
Right, so, and your point being that there has to be this other internal organ, let's say, or quasi-organ, that is ruling, well, it's making the decision anyway. It's taking the data and it's turning it into action.
Well, depending on whether it's a reflex. I mean, if it's the doctor hitting your knee, then no, the mind is not involved in that because your leg just goes forward before you have a chance to think about it.
But isn't that a kind of an unknown spectrum? Because, for example, if a beetle's come whizzing at your head and maybe you did martial arts or maybe just you're very aware that day and you actually raise your hand and block the beetle before you've had, and that's a reflex, but on any other day or somebody who hadn't done martial arts, they wouldn't have had that reflex. Right? So it's not just the reflex that you're talking about. It isn't just because somebody hit you on the knee. It can also be because you're very attuned to something that's about to happen. You actually hear or sense the beetle heading for your head, and you deflect it. So that's the kind of consciousness that I would say is superior to the mind. And
yeah,
it also involves a decision. A decision is made.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things going on in everyone's body that, you know, you wouldn't be able to function if your ego had to process, you know, all of that information. I mean, these things have to be able to operate autonomously.
Mm-hmm. I just realized something. It's why you love ping pong so much. Because you can't play ping pong with the mind, right? Not really.
Yeah, it's yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm checked out for 2 hours.
Yeah. Right.
It's like I guess are you able to meditate?
I'm with you. I would play ping pong or I do jigsaw puzzle, which is the opposite extreme. It's very, you know, slow, but it's still, you don't use your mind to do these things. Your mind just is like do do do. Yeah.
Right.
It's
yeah.
Just spinning its wheels.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just your everything is reflexive. I mean, to be good at sports. I mean, that's what they, when I was taking fencing in college, that's what they taught us. They were like, you know, if you have to think about what you're gonna do, when you're fencing, you're gonna lose pretty quick. You've got to make everything, all your skill has to be reflexive. Because if you have to mm-hmm. think about it, it's gonna be way, you're gonna get poked. You know. And lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and my point about this was, and it's definitely true of ping pong, you're playing with another person, you're responding to their cues, their moves, it's very enjoyable, there's a feeling of being in communication with somebody that isn't at a mind level, it's often very funny, for me anyway. Mm-hmm. That kind of, I use the term responsibility, or rather I emphasize how the word responsibility can be split that way, and an ability to respond to one's environment and to the other, to me that's much closer to a fully embodied, a fully enjoyable and fully satisfying experience of being alive. And it does seem to often, or I would say maybe always, center around letting the mind take a back seat and being, well, like the body, whether you could say it's programmed or designed or however, whatever language you use, but the body naturally responds to its environment, like back to instincts. And, you know, ping pong it's not a survival-based activity, but it is an activity where the body, because of what the body naturally knows how to do, it then applies it to ping pong, you know, and gets to do what the body's so good at, which is constantly responding to the stimuli in the environment. And to me, that's being more alive, being more in the body.
Right, and so obviously this transcender android, you'd agree that I could build an android that plays ping pong in a manner that you know, if my biological body were to die and this thing were to show up, you know, at the club the next night and it was a really, really good, you know, robot, you know, fool everyone into thinking it was me, let's say, because, you know, I have a very defensive game and I hit a lot of lobs and a lot of blocks and everything like that. I mean, I could program, you know, this transcender would you know, play that same way so that nobody would notice that that's not me.
Well, you'd have to program the Android to enjoy itself and to communicate enjoyment, assuming that you do that. And then the question is, would it be actually enjoying or would it merely imitate it? And I think you've already implied that there'd be no way to know that for sure. You can't ask the Android, are you sentient? Well, I don't know, maybe you can. I don't know if it's programmed not to lie, but how would you know for sure that,
Well, I mean,
it was following its...
this thing has its own, ego and monologue going. Like, I mean, when I'm playing table tennis, what happens is, somebody serves the ball, we hit it back and forth, mm-hmm. somebody misses, the point is over, and then my mind steps in at that point and, starts communicating with the other person, and we'll talk back and forth, or we'll laugh, or we'll this, that, the other. But that's like an evaluation of the point that just occurred.
Now. Okay, so would your Android then, even in the best possible world, I guess we'll say, but would it be designed to have a neural intestinal network and a neural heart network and a neural brain network? Would you try and actually replicate all of the nodes of consciousness that exist in the human body, or would you just create an efficient machine and then stick Anil's persona on the face so that it had a speaker to communicate its, machine experience?
I would assume that in order to replicate my persona, that I have to have all of those subsystems operating properly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean...
Right. So then you're basically talking about redesigning the universe.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that DNA does not have a monopoly on consciousness, on life, on carbon. I mean, you can have everything you want, or everything that's in carbon can also occur in a silicon medium.
Right, so that's the premise, and as you say, you're thousands of years away from testing it. But what's the point then? We're back to that. Like, the universe has already created these perfect bodies, and they live, but they die, but still, then more of them are created, and so on, and they play ping pong, and they enjoy, and so on. What's the point in actually just reinventing the wheel of the human organism?
Well, why? Well, you have to ask, why was the human organism invented then?
Do I?
Well, you're saying that we're here out of sheer randomness? I mean,
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying it already exists, so why reinvent it? Why invent a perfect Android replica of you or of human beings or of anything when we have the original model already?
Well, because these bodies... Well, from a personal point of view, it's so that I can complete what I believe I was put here to do, that the reason for me being here, to fulfill that destiny. I can't do it in another 50 years. I mean, we're so that's from a personal standpoint. But then there's also from the point of view of the universe, and why did it put us here? Why are we here?
Mm-hmm. And your answer is to create Android replicas of ourselves.
Well, why do you think that humans are here, or life is here?
I'm not sure if you want... I mean, I guess you do want me to answer that, but...
I mean, I'll tell you what I think, but I was just wondering if you might answer first.
I would say that something very simple would be my answer. That we're here to fully experience being in the flesh, being organic, being physical, being embodied, and to share and transmit love to one another and experience connections with one another while we're here. Now, what the point of that is, and how that has any continued meaning after our death, I can really only speculate. But I do think it does transcend death, that purpose that I've outlined, which is incredibly simple, but also unbelievably hard.
So let's okay. Do you believe that we were put here by the sun or the earth? I mean, is there someone responsible for putting us here? Can we project upon the earth and the sun and these celestial bodies that
like parents?
Right. Yeah. I mean, can we project that upon them? Is that a safe projection to make?
I wouldn't say it was a safe one. I'm not sure if there are any safe ones, really, because the projections, you know, lead to delusions. But I mean, it depends also on how much projection is in it and how much just sort of poetic license. So that the sun and earth are our metaphorical parents, and that together they generated human beings in a similar way that human beings have children, just to further their own enjoyment of each other, something like that. Maybe I'd say, yeah, that's quite a nice poetic metaphor, and it's sort of physically, technically true that the earth and sun co-created humanity.
Right. Well, that's a good question. It's like, why do people have children? And, you know, I guess the, you know, one answer would be is to take care of them in old age, right?
Well, that would be a very cynical answer, but quite a cynical one. But yeah, I think it's very true. And before that, just to enrich their lives and heighten their status and so on. I think people have children for quite selfish reasons.
Right.
Not that there should be a judgment in that, but there is. I can't help it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we could make a big, long list of all the reasons that people have children and, you know, and put them, like, in the human column, and then we could make another list of the earth and the sun, you know, why they would want to have us as children. And I think the one about, you know, taking care of them in their old age, I think that would go in both columns, don't you?
No, I don't. And I think that when you add want to it, that's where our different projections would diverge, because I don't see in this metaphorical poetic model, I don't see the sun and earth as wanting to have children and getting together and saying, honey, do you think we should? I just see it as a natural development of their natures, that when you get the sun and the earth within close enough proximity, just like man and woman, they're going to want to enjoy each other, you know, and they just do it. And the reason that men and women have children is because they can't help it. They want to fuck. That's really it. All that other stuff, we're back to the glasses in the hand, but the body just does it, and then the mind afterwards comes up with reasons and justifications for it. But they're not actually the reason that it happened, in my opinion. That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Anil Pandey. Part two of this conversation will be up next Wednesday, the 2nd of August 2017 at horticulture.com/liminalist. Very, very grateful thanks to Eileen, Simon and Maria. Three very generous donations this week. It's nice to be appreciated. I'm traveling as of next week to Europe. I'm going to be in London and in Yorkshire and in Finland at various different dates. If anyone would like to meet up, well, not anyone, but if you would like to meet up with me in London, send me a line and introduce yourself, or if I know you already, then you won't need to do that, but let me know anyway. It's Jason with a U at horticulture.com. I don't know if I'll be able to keep up the podcast. I mean, I know I won't be for some of the time, but I'll try to get at least a couple of podcasts backed up before I leave. Right, I believe that's it for one more week. This is Jason, between the podcast, The Liminalist, horticulture.com. Thanks for your support.